Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So even as he faces what could be a successful round of primaries today, Donald Trump's campaign has jarred a lot of this country's institutions. The Republicans now scrambling to defeat Donald Trump acknowledge they were unprepared for this phenomenon and waited too long to act. Now, at the same time, a lot of political journalists are wondering if their reluctance to be more critical of Trump's candidacy has actually helped enable it. Look, I'm a guy who very early on refused to talk about Donald Trump at all on this show. I thought that a TV reality hucksterish birther-fueled candidacy was best ignored, like a bad commercial. But Trump's candidacy is very viable now. And now the question, what does it mean to be strictly objective, to weigh one side against the other, when the content of a campaign includes incitement to violence, xenophobia, and in some cases, racism? If journalists are strictly objective then, weighing one side with the other, are they serving listeners and readers, or does it only normalize aberrance into our political discourse? Put another way, should journalists take a neutral view of Donald Trump's candidacy, given the ingredients that he's chosen for it? Samuel Friedman is a professor of journalism and journalistic ethics at Columbia Journalism School.
I think in a media landscape that's so oversaturated with opinion already, there's more of a need than ever for the best form of traditional nonpartisan reporting as opposed to commentary. But that doesn't mean being lazy as a reporter and doesn't mean taking false refuge in on the one hand, on the other hand. But I think the answer, not for commentators and opinion writers or opinion broadcasters, but the answer for the reporters out in the field working for traditional news organizations is to do more reporting, that you don't have to put a label on what Trump says to say this is racism or this is bigotry. You can answer it, first of all, by getting other people to comment on it. You can answer it with the facts. When Trump talks about Mexico sending rapists and criminals, all a reporter has to do is go and find the data, as some have, to show that undocumented immigrants of all kinds are underrepresented rather than overrepresented in America's prison system. That answers it right there. I think as soon as a reporter who's out in the field covering this as a reporter starts taking it upon herself or himself to put labels on what Trump says, you're falling into his game. His game is to say that the media is biased against him and to punch back against it. Why fall into that when really the facts more than amply answer it? And also, if you trust your viewers and listeners and readers, then when someone says, let's beat up a protester, you know, in the good old days, someone would be carried out on a stretcher. For a reasonably intelligent news consumer, that's pretty obviously incitement.
At the same time, I'll give you an example, Samuel Friedman. I saw a respected colleague on television just the other night get asked about what's behind some of the incitement and some of the violence at Donald Trump rallies. The B-roll over this question was a black person getting punched in the face. His answer to this question was, it's about economic anxiety. This is a euphemism, and surely that doesn't serve viewers for him to say that.
Well, I think that that's just a misreading of history. There's an element of economic anxiety that's part of Trump's base and also a bigger part of Bernie Sanders' base. But you could be historically accurate and say that there's been a tradition of Republican presidential candidates and presidents, with a few notable exceptions, like Gerald Ford and George W. Bush, playing on racial resentment. It goes back to Barry Goldwater, and it runs through Ronald Reagan. It runs through the first President Bush. It runs through Mitt Romney. So it runs through Sarah Palin. It's been a steady theme. And you can say that, and you're merely citing the historical evidence. And that will make the point that this kind of appeal doesn't come from nowhere. You can also talk about the historical antecedent of a race like George Wallace's in 1968, which touched a lot of the same themes that Trump's did. It surprisingly worked well among northern blue-collar voters. It used a lot of barely coded language about race and anti-government. That's good reporting. That doesn't mean, you know, taking the side of an opinionizer. It means doing your work.
So to the extent that journalism enabled Trump, to the extent we should even be worried about that, you say that laziness enabled Donald Trump, not a cult of objectivity refusing to criticize him.
I agree. And laziness can masquerade sometimes as objectivity. And first of all, there's no such thing as objectivity. Humans are subjective. I never use that word approvingly in my classes. What you're talking about in the pre-Fox News meaning of the word is a fairness, is an ability to weigh evidence. The false refuge is to say on the one hand, on the other hand, you know, you can apply, think about applying that to the Holocaust or to the idea of genetic inferiority of one race. You wouldn't do on the one hand, on the other hand. That wouldn't be effective reporting or fairness. It would be imbalance. You can't do that with climate change when there's a preponderance of opinion on one side. But the other thing we haven't touched on is Trump has benefited from the conflation of information and journalism in this perpetual news cycle. I talked about George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama, being the antecedent for Trump. But George Wallace was an outsider to the New York entertainment industry. George Wallace never would have been a guest on Smothers Brothers Show or Laugh-In back in the 60s, but Donald Trump gets to guest host Saturday Night Live in the middle of this campaign. What does that say about the complicity of the entertainment industry in him? What does it say about the fact that his launching pad to this race is, among other things, the TV show The Apprentice? So that's what's complicated here, is that he comes out of the familiar circles of New York entertainment and society and big money. He's not an alien to big media, it's true, the way that someone like George Wallace or Barry Goldwater was, and they were looked at more skeptically. And he's able to use, obviously now, social media and all kinds of other new tools to get his message perpetually out there and to build ratings in a way George Wallace couldn't, because there was no internet then, there was no social media then, there was no talk radio or cable TV in the current meaning of those terms when he was running his races.
While we're here talking about journalism, I want to talk about myself just for a second, because very early on in the Trump phenomenon on this show, I tried to not discuss Donald Trump. I wanted it to be a no-Trump zone. I thought that a marketer and a huckster and a birther and somebody with proto-racism behind his early political activities was best ignored, because like an annoying ad, it would go away. That hasn't happened, and I missed something important. Was I wrong to want to have a no-Trump place early on?
I don't think it was wrong to err against over-covering him. And I don't think it was wrong to treat Trump like that initially. I think it was the right move. But you have to then deal with the fact that he has tapped into this very large voting base, probably a third of the Republican primary electorate as a whole, and is the front runner, and you can't ignore him.
Samuel Friedman is a professor of journalism at Columbia Journalism School. I'm glad you were here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Todd.